BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. Being a mother in Victorian Britain wasn't easy, especially if your child was born outside marriage. There was the shame of that, the economic burden of it. Sometimes the only option was to make the heartbreaking decision to let someone else look after your baby.
Married couple with no family would adopt a healthy child. Nice country home. Terms £10. Harding. Stokes Croft, Bristol. Married couple having no child would adopt one. Good home, small premium. Mrs. Thornley, Stokes Croft. Highly respectable married couple wish to adopt child. Good country home. Premium required. Very small. Many thanks for your letter this morning. I assure you I will do my duty to the dear child. I will be a mother as far as possible in my power. If you would like to come and stay a few days or a week later on, I shall be pleased to make you welcome. It's just lovely here in the summer. There is an orchard opposite our front door. I think Doris is a very pretty name. She left Cheltenham with the baby by the 5:20 train. I went with her as far as Gloucester. I took with me a cardboard box containing baby clothes. The baby was dressed in a fawn-coloured pelisse and a white bonnet. These are the actual things it went away in. The child was quite well when it left me. She appeared to be an affectionate woman. She told me that the carpet bag contained eggs and clothing.
Welcome back to Lady Killers, the programme that uses crime as a way into Victorian women's lives. We're taking a look, yes, a feminist look, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses in Victorian Britain, North America and beyond. Why did these women do it? The answer lies in the world in which they lived. Now, can you imagine the poignancy of having to give away your child to someone else? To hand over a little warm body to a stranger at a railway station? The desperation that must have led you to this point? And then to discover the person you trusted with your child wasn't what she'd seemed. In the 19th century, unmarried women who got pregnant had extremely limited choices. It's horrifying to learn that the maid working for Scottish writer Jane Carlyle was so frightened to let on that she was pregnant that she gave birth in the cupboard next door to Jane Carlyle's drawing room. But there was a solution to all your childcare problems. You could farm out your baby for a fee to somebody else, somebody called a baby farmer. Today, we're looking at the case of a Victorian baby farmer who didn't keep her side of the bargain. Rather than giving the children a safe and loving home, she would simply murder them. Either by drugging them with an opiate-laced cordial called, unbelievably, it was called Mother's Friend, or else by strangling them and throwing them into the river. She's thought to have killed between 200 and 400 children. I've got two guests today to help me unpick this horrible case. One of them's a real-life detective. Jackie Moulton is a former detective chief inspector who was the inspiration for the TV series Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren. How cool is that? Hello, Jackie.
Hello.
And we're also joined by our in-house historian, Rosalind Crone from the Open University, an oracle on all things Victorian. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
Ros, why would Victorian women use a baby farmer?
Well, Lucy, in the early 19th century, fathers were held responsible for any illegitimate children they spawned. They were forced to pay or even marry the mothers. In an effort to curb rates of illegitimacy, the new poor law of 1834 made mothers solely financially responsible for their illegitimate children up to the age of 16. Now, the idea behind this was that the consequences of pregnancy outside of wedlock would be so bad that women would guard their chastity. So an unmarried mother, not supported by her family, had few options: infanticide, the workhouse, or to pay a stranger, a baby farmer, to look after her child. And in 1896, the year of our case, the Reverend Benjamin Waugh estimated that there were around 50,000 babies born out of wedlock every year, and perhaps as many as 600 baby farmers of dubious character.
And this is an unregulated industry, effectively.
That's exactly right.
Now, Jackie, it's great to have you with us today to give us your expertise. Can you tell us a bit about your background in the Met Police?
Yes, I was a detective. I always wanted to be a detective. I dealt with armed robberies. I did murders. I did rapes, blackmail, probably across the whole spectrum of crime. I investigated it in one way or the other during the years I was a detective.
Can you introduce us to the detective team on this particular case and what sort of a job you think that they did?
Well, I think in view of forensics being in its infancy back then, I think they did an absolutely fantastic job.
Oh.
Yeah, I do. And they were led by a chief constable in Reading called George Tewsley. He was a portly gentleman with a commanding presence. He had a handlebar moustache. His number two was a detective constable, James Anderson, originally from Aberdeen. Joined by Sergeant Harry James, all working for Reading Borough Police.
Now, we're not going to reveal the name of our lady killer just yet, because we'd like you to follow the evidence, just like our team of Victorian detectives did. The case begins on a cold, dank morning, when a bargeman called Charles Humphreys is driving his boat down the River Thames at Reading.
On Monday at about 11:30, I was pulling the ballast boat up the shore to the King's Meadows when I saw a brown paper parcel floating on the top of the water about 7 feet from the shore. I pointed out the parcel to me mate, and he undid the paper and cut through two thickness of flannel, and we saw a child's foot and part of its leg.
Now, Roz and Jackie are going to follow in the footsteps of detectives Tewsley, Anderson and James, and they're going to head to the place where this first body was found. And then they're going to go on to the Thames Valley Police Museum to look at the evidence.
If we take you back to 1896, this lock in Caversham near to Reading was known to the locals as the Clappers. It used to have a wooden footbridge across it and was used frequently during the day, but at night it would have been absolutely deserted. This is where our baby farmer, the lady killer, got rid of the infants in her charge. How many babies were thought to have been thrown into the Thames, do you think, Roz?
During the police investigation that stretched from about 30th of March through to the end of April in 1896, they recovered seven bodies from this stretch of the river here. But the police said, you know, they were convinced that there were many more that were never, ever recovered. She sometimes took up to six babies a day from their parents.
Yeah.
So just doing the maths on that suggests a pretty large number.
But finding seven bodies, that's a really shocking number.
It is in one sense, and especially to our ears today. But I think what we've got to remember here is that deaths of babies is not particularly unusual in this period, if we think about high mortality rates for infants, disease, but also parental involvement in the death. So babies could die from exposure, from neglect, from poor feeding practices, and sometimes the bodies were just disposed of. That is even before we get into the idea of properly unwanted children. Sure. Children born out of wedlock, illegitimate children, and also children born into families that were already large and struggling to cope. How do you deal with these infants? Infants died, bodies were disposed of.
By disposing the body in the river, that was kind of an accepted practice.
Society turned a bit of a blind eye because these were the unwanted children. They were the problem in society and people didn't know really how to deal with them properly.
Did anyone see this baby farmer in the area?
Three witnesses came forward during the investigation. The first was a man called William Povey, and he was a retired ironmonger. And he claimed that he had seen the killer in the recreation ground at about 11:20 on the morning of Monday, the 30th of March. That's the same day they found the first body. He said she was carrying a brown paper parcel. She went to the river. Eventually, she turned around and began to walk away. And he noticed that she no longer had the brown paper parcel. Another witness came forward, a house agent, who claimed to have seen the killer carrying a carpet bag that was apparently so heavy
that she had to stop at intervals on her walk to rest. And finally, an engineer who worked at Reading Prison, a man called John Toller, saw our lady killer late at night on the 2nd of April, walking towards him away from the river.
So, Ros, we have a body, we've got a location, and even we've got a sighting. But that's not much to go on, though, is it?
No, it isn't. But we're about to go and see a really significant piece of evidence that finally put our lady killer on the police's radar.
We've come to the Thames Valley Police Museum to look at some exhibits. So what are we actually looking at, Ros?
It's a bundle of brown paper, a little bit of newspaper sticking out from the inside. It's relatively small, but it does become quite large when you open it out. Now, this is the wrapping that the first baby found in the river was wrapped in. And alongside it, we have the tape that was found around the baby's neck. And we also have the string that tied the whole parcel together.
And evidentially, you've got three brilliant exhibits there. It is really good evidence to present to a court.
Yeah, absolutely. When they took this paper wrapping to the mortuary and they laid it out on the table, they unwrapped it, they found a railway stamp with a date and also a name and address.
What did the railway stamp say?
So it was a railway stamp for Bristol Temple Mead, and then the address said to Mrs. Thomas, number 26, Piggott's Road, Caversham, Reading, along with a date.
That's fairly good evidence, I'd suggest.
Yeah, it's fantastic evidence. The newspapers at the time reported that the police, seeing this evidence, went to the railway station and spoke to the parcel clerk about this stamp. Now, how does that sound to you?
That doesn't sound feasible to me. If I was investigating this way back then, common sense would tell me, as a police officer, that I would go to that address and knock on the door and ask for Mrs. Thomas. If there was nobody at the house, I would do house-to-house inquiries, and from there, I'm likely to get information of who that person is, who else lives in that house, how long they've lived there, and can you give me, more importantly, a description of the occupants of that house? That's really good intelligence.
If they had gone directly to the house, they would not have found a Mrs. Thomas. It was an alias. We know from the press reports that the railway clerk gave them some very important information, which was that Mrs. Thomas was not the real name of the recipient of the parcel, and that she had moved to a new address, which was number 45 Kensington Road in Reading.
That's a fair assumption.
Okay, the string is crucial in this case as well. The police went to the address, there was no one home, and so they began to make inquiries in the area and knock on doors. A neighbour answered the door, and she remembered having lent string just like this to the occupant of 45 Kensington Road on the same morning that the parcel containing the baby was found in the river.
Wow, that's strong evidence.
Yeah, that is strong evidence. Even stronger evidence was the tape. Now, this is a tape that was found around the neck of the baby, suggesting strangulation. When they later raided the house at Kensington Road, they found identical tape inside the house.
Where does the story take us from here, Ros?
Right, well, we've got the packaging, we've got the address. Now we've got to catch the killer.
I'm with you.
If you were investigating this case yourself, Jackie, what would you do next?
I'd send in a decoy undercover officer purporting to be a woman that wanted to sell her baby. I've done decoy work many, many times when I was a much younger officer, mainly in sexual cases. So women that had been sexually assaulted, raped, flashed at. So instead of putting a member of the public, say, can you walk down that path? Then the police put one of their own to walk down the path, and that was kind of just common practice. But do you know what? It was quite scary. You know, your heart's in your mouth as you're walking down trying to look nonchalant.
It's fascinating that this is a regular part of crime detection. So what do our detectives do next? They go to 45 Kensington Road on the 3rd of April with a decoy. She's the wife of a police officer, no female officers then. She pretends she wants her baby to be fostered. She's told, come back later with your child and with £50. That's a lot of money. Instead, though, the people who do come back later are the policemen themselves. They knock on the door and they arrest a woman called Amelia Dyer. A thorough search is made of the house. The police find letters between this Amelia Dyer and her son-in-law, Arthur Palmer. And these letters seem to imply that she wasn't working alone. Palmer is going to get a visit from the police too. They also find evidence. Mountains of baby clothes, vaccination certificates, telegrams, letters from parents, receipts for newspaper ads that have been placed, and a box with a foul stench, similar to the smell of a corpse. But crucially, there are no further bodies. So our baby farmer has been revealed as Amelia Dyer. Born in Bristol, her father was a shoemaker, and her mother, who died when Amelia was 11, likely suffered from a mental illness. Amelia became a nurse, but soon found something that was far better paid. She began to advertise in newspapers, saying she'd take in babies. She married William Dyer and had two children, William and Mary Ann. And she started to have brushes with the law. Several babies died in her care, and she was accused of neglect. She got 6 months in prison, but once she was out again, she set up in the baby business once more. The police were suspicious of her now. At least one distraught mother had reported Dyer, but each time the police came near, Dyer would talk of suicide, ending up in an asylum. She had three asylum spells in 3 years, but she still kept on with the business, now joined by her daughter Marianne and her son-in-law, Arthur Palmer. Dyer finally moved to 45 Kensington Road in Reading. And Marianne and Arthur moved to Willesden in North London, setting up a new baby farm there. What the police were now looking for were more bodies. Neighbours said at least 20 children had been taken into the household in the 2 months before Dyer's arrest. When Dyer appeared in the magistrate's court herself, she had no help to give.
I do not know anything about it. It's all a mystery to me.
And Arthur Palmer, the son-in-law, said something similar when he was brought in. Finally, the police get a breakthrough. On April the 10th, a man dragging the river finds a carpet bag weighed down with bricks. It contains what turn out to be the bodies of Doris Marmon and Henry Simmons. 6 days later, in Reading jail, Amelia Dyer asks for a pen and paper and writes two letters, one to her son-in-law Arthur and one to Chief Constable Tewsley. This letter sounds like a confession. Jackie and Roz, you saw this confession at the Thames Valley Police Museum, didn't you? Let's hear it.
To the Chief Superintendent of Police, sir, I do know and I feel my days...
I do know and feel my days are numbered on this earth, but I do feel it's an awful thing to draw innocent people into trouble. I do know I shall have to answer to my Maker in heaven for these awful crimes I have committed. And as God Almighty is my judge in heaven as on earth, neither my daughter nor her husband had anything to do with it.
All witness my hand, Amelia Dyer. Roz, this letter... Dyer is wanting to take full responsibility for this. What do you think about her confession?
What is her game plan here? I think it's two. First of all, I think it is to get Arthur Palmer off the hook. Okay, she wants him out of this. She will take full responsibility. I also think what she's trying to do here is shut it down. Shut down the investigation. She's aware they keep finding bodies. She knows that there are more in that river. Okay, this is the 16th of April. The inquests on the bodies haven't been concluded yet at this stage. She's hoping it'll be read to the magistrates on the 18th of April. This letter comes to the attention of the newspapers. They get a rumour about it and they start publishing. The police try to shut it down. They say, they declare in the newspaper, there is no letter. We are aware of no confession. This letter is held back weeks. And it finally is presented to the magistrates at the police court on the 2nd of May, when the police are ready to press for a trial.
I accept that the police did a very good investigation about that. I'm not taking anything away from them, but I'm going to mention one thing. And one thing that really, really worries me is why they did not pursue Palmer and Dyer's daughter and implicate them in baby farming. And the reason that I'm saying that is that Palmer and his wife move to a rented accommodation in Willesden in North London. Mr. Cullum rents the property out to them. And prior to that, he had removed a fireplace and put the bricks into the back garden. In those days, the bricks were handmade and the brickmaker would put his signature on the bricks. The evidence shows that the bricks used in the deaths of some of these babies in order to weigh down the body in the River Thames were the same bricks from Willesden. That is compelling evidence that Palmer and his wife were involved. And what I don't understand about this, in today's policing, that would have been further developed and investigated.
I completely agree with you. I mean, their guilt seems pretty clear.
And Mrs. Dyer, as I understand it, she pleads that she's insane. So she's very, very manipulative. I will row out my son-in-law and daughter. I'll put in a plea of insanity. They'll believe me. So she was very manipulative by writing that letter.
We're going to talk a bit more about whether Amelia Dyer really was mentally ill or not in a minute, but first let's continue with our case. On the 11th of April, two women are brought to Reading Court. Evelina Marmon is single, she's a barmaid, and the mother of baby Doris. Amelia Sargent is a married woman with 15 children of her own who had been looking after baby Henry on behalf of his mother, who'd gone into service as a lady's maid. This is what they say when they identify Dyer in a lineup.
That is the dreadful woman to whom I handed Doris. That's the vile creature who had the little fellow.
Later, Amelia Sargent would testify at the Old Bailey.
I left her thoroughly satisfied as a person to leave the little boy with. I felt quite sure she would be kind to him. I saw Mrs. Thomas and her niece onto a bus to Royal Oak. She took the baby and I said, "Be kind to it." She said, "Trust me for that." I kissed it before she took it away.
After that, Amelia Dyer is off to trial at the Old Bailey for the murders of the two babies. But there isn't enough evidence to try her daughter and son-in-law. Dyer's solicitor decides that her defence should be a plea of insanity. What do you think about that then, Jackie?
I think it's a really good defence for the following reasons, that Amelia Dyer grew up with a mother who suffered from mental illness. Amelia Dyer herself had gone into sanatoriums on two or three occasions, and that she felt that if she could put this defence forward, that she was mentally ill when she killed all of those babies, that she would take full responsibility and not put anybody else into the picture.
So we know that she was a clever woman. This is a tactic that makes sense to you as a detective.
Yes, she's a manipulating woman.
And what are your views, Ros?
Well, the defence team put up several witnesses to show that Dyer was insane. But at the same time, the prosecution produced an equal number of witnesses to say that she wasn't. At the end of the day, it was down to the jury, and the jury bought the prosecution's arguments.
After hearing evidence for 2 days, the jury take just 5 minutes to find Amelia Dyer guilty of the willful murder of Doris Marmon and Henry Simmons. On the 10th of June, at Newgate Prison, Amelia Dyer is hanged. Wills, what was the public's response to this case?
It might surprise you, Lucy, that there wasn't a wholesale condemnation of Dyer despite what she had done. But commentators at the time understood that this problem was deeply rooted in society and culture.
That seems completely amazing to me.
It does, and it's really interesting to look at what was coming through the women's press in particular. So, for example, the Women's Penny Paper, in an editorial, blamed the parents who gave their children away to baby farmers like Dyer, not the baby farmers themselves.
But whilst this was a really high-profile case, wasn't it, did some things change?
Yes, there was legislative change, which was intended to strengthen the 1872 Infant Life Protection Act, and that new legislation came out in 1897. It was better. It raised the protected age so that minders with more than one child up to the age of five had to notify local authorities. But it was still not good enough. Baby farming continued into the 20th century. The problem remained of what to do with unwanted children who were born to mothers unable to take care of them. Baby farming was a product of a system of inequality, a system that relieved men of responsibility, that punished women for moral transgressions, and which limited women's financial independence so they couldn't earn enough to support a single-parent household or to afford good quality childcare.
This society basically left women holding the baby.
That's exactly right.
Jackie, what actually happened to the wretched Arthur Palmer and Mary Ann?
There was no news of the daughter and son-in-law for the next 2 years, but in 1898 they were charged with abandoning a child. They'd advertised in a newspaper to adopt an infant, and in September they'd received a three-week-old girl with £12 at a station in Devonport. Now, this little child was later found under the seat of a railway carriage. She was tired and cold, but alive. And for that, Arthur and Mary Palmer were sentenced to 2 years in prison.
I think, Jackie, that if you were in charge, you'd have done a better job than those policemen did and you'd have got them banged up for life.
I would have got them much earlier and they would have been charged with murder.
Now, I'm sure at this point we're all breathing a sigh of relief and thinking, thank goodness, we're so much more civilised than those Victorians. It is now okay to be unmarried, and baby farming no longer exists. But how much more civilised are we really? Perhaps not as much as we'd like to think. Hundreds of women, even in the 1970s, in my lifetime, were still forced, if unmarried, to give up their babies for adoption. And the issue of who should look after the children is far from resolved. State support for childcare doesn't kick in until the child is two. And everyone knows that good quality, affordable childcare is not easy to find. You'd think, nearly 130 years on from Amelia Dyer, that we'd have sorted this out. But we haven't, have we? Well, thanks for your help to Jackie and to Ros. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to the northeast, to County Durham, to meet Mary Ann Cotton, who's thought to have murdered three out of four husbands. Don't miss an episode. Search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Julia Hable. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The music's composed by Asher Nathan and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
J. Edgar Hoover created and ran the FBI for almost 50 years.
Nobody should have that powerful position for that length of time.
His job was to enforce the law, but he did not always follow it.
Hoover was basically creating a secret police.
Find out what his FBI looked like.
This is like Stasi.
And hear firsthand from the group who had an astonishing plan to expose him.
We became convinced that the FBI was illegal.
From BBC Radio 4. The People versus J. Edgar Hoover with me, Emily Maitlis. Listen first on BBC Sounds.